Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
We welcome all of our listeners to this episode of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Leighton Behind the Scenes, thanking you for downloading and listening to this show. Coming up today, we've got a fantastic interview, one of our longer interviews of recent vintage, Mike Provence, the CEO of 3x3. 3x3 is a company, and we'll let Mike discuss this during the interview, but they assist a number of especially independent liquor, beer, wine, and spirits retailers. And he's joining the show to give us kind of a heads up on where everything is at in this retail industry. He's going to talk about trends, things to watch for 2021, the state of ownership in the space, and also what independent retailers did during the pandemic to ensure that they were hanging on to customers as companies like Target and Walmart and other big box stores and other grocery store chains were really fighting for this demographic. It's a fascinating interview, and I assure you, even if you have not the slightest interest in this segment of retail, it's an interview you're going to want to hear because you'll learn something from it. I know I sure did. In our news segment, we'll talk about more holiday sales updates with Nordstrom and Target, and we'll look ahead to a company in the pet retail space launching another IPO or going public again. A quick reminder that you can rate us however you access us. So if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or if you're listening on Spotify, those ratings do help listeners to find our show and check us out. We've got already several new listeners coming on board in the new year. Also, you can check us out on social media at Retail Podcast, Instagram, and Twitter. So as I mentioned, we discussed L Brands holiday sales last week. We get more holiday sales updates this week. And we begin with Target. And it's fair to say that Target picked up where they left off in the third quarter. As they did in their most recent quarter, they saw expanded traffic in both stores and online. Online sales more than doubled over last year, up 102%. This is slightly more than what we've seen in terms of e-com sales increases for Target of late, but not so far out of line that it's a massive jump. Specifically, when you look at digital sales, same-day services, sales were up 193% year-over-year. Drive-up services up over 500%. Shipped-based delivery, of course, shipped owned by Target, grew over 300%. Their brick-and-mortar comps, meanwhile, which it bears mention, they are much more mature, of course, in the brick-and-mortar space, but they rose 4.2%. Now, that would be good even in a non-pandemic year, and certainly good when you take into account that Target didn't even get to the 2% mark in terms of comps last year. So a great year overall, even considering everything going on this year for Target and their typical increases. I think this is more than what a lot of people, including ourselves, would have expected. Now, regarding that traffic, we said that was up this year. Traffic was up 4.3%. Ticket size increased 12.3%. So it's a similar breakdown to what we've been seeing in a number of retail sectors. But the fact that that traffic is up for Target, and it was up their last full quarter for Target as well, that is a great sign for them. And it shows a number of different things. You know, one of the things we've talked to companies who survey consumers about on the show over the last 3 months, and if you've listened to the show over the last 3 months, you've heard this, cleanliness and safety were main deciding factors for consumers in deciding where to shop or who to shop with during the holidays. And I think Target was in a positive position here because customer perception of cleanliness at Target has historically been high. So as a result, I think you're seeing that traffic go up in stores at Target because customers have that trust of Target, knowing that they can take care of their stores, keep their stores clean, keep their stores safe. And Target's done a great job in terms of messaging this as well. Now, Marshall Cohen of the NPD Group was actually quoted in the Minneapolis Star Tribune as saying that the customers that Target won over during the pandemic, they seemed to come back during the holidays. So the people that were buying cleaning supplies, the people that were buying food, came back to buy home goods. They came back to buy gifts. Other analysts cited Target's position as a one-stop shop as kind of assisting them in this process and maybe taking some of those sales away from department stores. So if you're going, if you're buying cleaning goods, if you're buying HBA items, you're buying grocery items, you're there you might as well pick up gifts as well. So whatever the cause, all we know is that Target is killing it, and certain categories saw major bumps. Home merchandise, of course, we've seen this across the board, so don't want to beat a dead horse here, but that saw a low 20% bump year over year in terms of sales for Target. Hardlines, including electronics, also saw a boost in the low 20% range. They were specific to say electronics were up as a subcategory by the mid-20s, and part of this, you would think, has to do with, of course, the release of new game consoles as well. Other successful categories for Target included beauty and essentials. That was up in the low teens. And food and beverage was up in line with overall increases. So about 17% year over year. That, of course, also a positive. But something a lot of analysts raised their eyebrows at in a good way was apparel. Apparel sales numbers grew high single digits for Target. And this is an atmosphere where companies are pretty happy if apparel numbers are pretty much flat year over year. Growing high single digits, not completely unheard of, but still suggestive of Target perhaps claiming market share from a lot of apparel-only retailers, one of whom we'll talk about, or a department store at least, in Nordstrom, who seem to struggle in their holiday sales numbers so far. And it's not just apparel-only retailers. We should say apparel-first retailers. A lot of those apparel-first department stores really struggling with some of those numbers that they're putting out. Now, one final note regarding Target before we move on to Nordstrom. Brian Cornell said in the prepared release that their sales were up in a similar fashion to their holiday sales so far in the new year. So this ball just keeps rolling along for Target. Their momentum shows no signs of stopping. All of this is a positive. We'll get final earnings numbers from Target in March, but certainly these holiday sales numbers and this holiday sales update has to be a positive as far as general merchandise retail is concerned and as far as specifically Target is concerned. Now, meanwhile, Nordstrom did not experience the same holiday fate. Instead, Nordstrom suffered a fate similar to other apparel-first or apparel-based department stores. Perhaps the most optimistic part of their sales update is an indication that sales and demand have begun to rebound so far in 2021, with demand maybe ticking up over what was expected in January, although they haven't released sales numbers to this point in January. Overall, sales during the nine-week holiday season that ended January 2nd dropped 22% versus last year. Granted, this was about what the company expected. I found it interesting because there are a lot of articles out there talking about basically Nordstrom coming up short in this quarter. The reality is the company expected something along these lines, and so while Nordstrom themselves said they'd like to have a better merchandise mix or should have had a better merchandise mix during the holiday season, sales still came in about what they expected. E-commerce was a bright spot, and this was a big part of their presentation that they put out along with the sales update. Digital sales accounted for a whopping 54% of their total sales. So that's not a 54% increase. It's not anything like that. 54% of Nordstrom's overall revenue came from e-commerce channels, which is a massive jump over where it was last year, which was in the mid-30s. That's still far higher than a lot of department stores were even last year, but 54% far outpaces some other department stores when you look at where they were at holiday season 2020. Overall, digital sales showed a 23% year-over-year improvement, so not that 102% number Target showed, but not a bad number either for a department store. The company made it a point to mention in their presentation about the topic, specifically e-commerce, that over 30% of online orders were fulfilled by their brick-and-mortar stores, with 11% of Nordstrom.com orders being picked up in-store. This number, by the way, found it interesting. The number grew to over 20% during the week immediately prior to Christmas. And when you think back to last week's interview with Tobias Buxhoit, he talked about how you're seeing this massive increase in misrouted shipments, delayed shipments from the fourth quarter based on his company's data. And I think what you were seeing the week prior to Christmas is obviously a distrust of any third-party logistics firm on behalf of the customer to get it to them on time. And then also you're seeing this willingness to use buy online pickup in store options that Nordstrom is providing. And while customers were coming to the physical stores less frequently, December sales at both Nordstrom and Nordstrom Rack did increase sequentially as well from November to December. So it wasn't just the buy online pickup in store sales that were increasing, it was overall sales as well. One other thing that we should remember is that Nordstrom Rack just rolled out buy online pickup in store capability in October. They finally aligned inventory across their website, NordstromRack.com, and their brick and mortar stores. So as a result, 9% of online Rack customers, not a ton, but a respectable number for something that just rolled out, chose to pick up their orders in store during this holiday period. The company also noted that this integration of inventory, of course, assisted in store fulfillment of online orders as well. And again, we talked about 30% of online orders in some way, shape, or form were fulfilled by the individual stores. And Nordstrom Rack, too, is more prevalent than the full price stores. I think this is something that people tend to forget. It's not all about those full price stores for Nordstrom. It's not all about those Nordstrom flagship stores. 249 Nordstrom Rack stores to 100 regular Nordstrom stores as of the end of the holiday season. So this integration of inventory was absolutely crucial to their ability to serve a wider customer base with increased fulfillment options. There are a lot of, I wouldn't call them mid-size markets, but maybe, you know, a second-tier market, if you will, similar to the market I'm in Colorado Springs, but a number of other markets have Nordstrom Rack stores. They don't have Nordstrom stores, and this gives people the capability to go online, order online, and pick up their item locally, where before the Rack inventory integration, this was not a possibility. So I do think this is a positive going forward for Nordstrom, and it could result in some momentum going into 2021, even though you're seeing decreased sales overall for the company. One other interesting facet from this presentation, gifting items specifically, made up 67% of sales. That's a 600 basis point increase year over year. And this might tell us something about customer sentiment during the holidays, or it could be a blip on the radar. We do want to be somewhat agnostic to that fact, but it still seems notable that their customer base was more focused on gifting than in years past. Bottom line, when it comes to the bottom line, positive earnings are expected for this quarter, Eric Nordstrom said during the presentation, despite a little bit of setback from costs from additional shipping surcharges. So primetime shipping surcharges, a real issue for Nordstrom as far as it pertained to their bottom line, but they're still feeling like they're going to come through with positive earnings. So good news overall for the company. I do think they set a little bit of a base for 2021, a little bit of a foundation there. So might be in better position than maybe a few other department stores out there. We'll wait and see as far as 2021 is concerned, but still, I think worthy of note on the podcast regarding their holiday sales. Well, coming up after this break, once again, we will be joined by the CEO of 3x3, Mike Provence. He'll discuss not only what 3x3 does to assist independent liquor retailers, but he's going to give us the lowdown on the state of liquor retail as a whole, where it might be headed in the future, some of the intricacies of this segment of retail, and some things that if you're not familiar with this area of retail, you might not have realized or might not have known about. And as I mentioned on the outset, even if this isn't an area of retail where you've worked in before, or maybe not of primary interest to you, I guarantee you're going to learn something from this interview. Well, we've talked a few times on the show just about how dynamic and interesting spirits retail is as an overall space. And we're pleased to be joined today by Mike Provence, the CEO of 3x3, to discuss a little bit about this space, also a little bit about the technology that 3x3 enables independent liquor retailers or spirits retailers to leverage to ensure that they are meeting the customers where they're at. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. Happy to be able to talk with you today about this.
So just so our listeners know a bit about your background, about 3x3's background, what is it that 3x3 does on the day-to-day?
Day-to-day, our job is to help retailers and brands keep the independent channel competitive and continue to be the source for discovery by the drinking consumer. the independent channel is a major factor in all bottle sales of alcohol. More than half of sales occur there, but most of the marketing dollars, most of the attention goes to the other side of the aisle, so to speak. And we see a need to help the independent retailer and the brands that depend on them stay very competitive. We do that by collecting intelligence about the transactions that occur in those stores, all the point of sale data, and use that data, that market and product intelligence, to build audience models that we can then drive marketing on behalf of the retailers and brands, that traffic locally to those stores in a much more focused way that's attentive to the needs of the consumers. We have about 1,500 locations across 32 states, so we've got a national footprint in terms of working with these independent retailers and basically covering all sorts of segments of audiences and consumers who shop for beer, wine, and spirits.
So you kind of mentioned it there, but you said a number of sales going to the other side of the aisle, so to speak. Something we've seen a lot of in recent years is deregulation. I know Target mentioned in a recent earnings call that it certainly helped build their bottom line. But from the perspective of someone that has worked in the industry that does it on a day-to-day basis, what is the state in 2021 of liquor retail, not just in terms of regulation, but in terms of ownership, in terms of sales and the like?
That's a great question. I think you do have to put that in a couple different contexts, right? One, there's the immediate, we're in the middle of a pandemic kind of context, but ownership and the structure of the industry and the market has been changing for the last, you know, 5, 7, 10 years, is all these different retailers that sell alcohol are competing for and kind of jockeying for position. And so you see things happen in states like Colorado or Kansas that, you know, pass laws allowing beer to be sold through grocery stores, full strength beer. And you see this kind of entire wave of demand shift over to the grocery store and many, many local retailers knocked out of business as a result of that. So there's been obviously battles in the Supreme Court over, you know, what is the definition of a resident who can have a license on a local liquor store. And I think what all of that is saying is that the light is shining on this industry, and the fact that the independent retailer represents such a big force in the industry that other people are trying to come in and figure out how to be kind of categorized as that, or how to take share away from that group. And, you know, when you're up against a Walmart or a Target or a Total Wine, where they have massive national weight and leverage in the industry, and all these small retailers have no way of aggregating their businesses into a large, you know, powerful voice in the market, that is having a major impact on ownership as states are changing the rules around who can own stores. And fortunately, you know, it's in some ways it's fortunate for the retailer that the difference in the importance of local retail is still very prominent in states. But at the same time, you have a change in the three-tier behavior, as now with some of the recent court rulings, you know, it's not just wine that's going direct to consumer. You're starting to see the lawsuits and changing regulations shape who can actually sell beer, wine, and spirits directly to consumers. And that can be an opportunity for retailers, but it's also a major threat to them.
So as you mentioned, a lot of things going on in this space this very year, at this moment in time. I do want to focus on the independent ownership of liquor stores, though, because as you mentioned, the way in which they attract customers necessarily differs because Walmart, Target, they all have this massive amount of brand equity. What are some ways in which independents can leverage the tools at hand to attract those consumers and make sure they're top of mind when it comes to consumer spirit buying decisions?
First and foremost, it's recognizing that they're not just another source of the same product. And what I mean by that is one of the advantages the local liquor store owner, the local retailer has, is that they can carry 10,000 SKUs at small numbers, small inventory sizes, you know, versus the Walmarts, the grocery stores. They all, either because of corporate rules or just the nature of how they buy product, they're buying fewer SKUs, they're buying higher volume, they have to be able to buy in high volume to get the kind of pricing deals. And so the local liquor retailer has an opportunity to focus their business on the kinds of customers that appreciate product and quality and choice over, say, the lowest priced white wine or red wine. And that is something that unfortunately, as we've talked to lots of retailers, they haven't quite seen their businesses that way. And they, you know, are more busy trying to figure out how they get access to the same products that are being sold down the street at a Kroger or down the street at a Target, rather than saying, how do we differentiate? How do we focus that business? And that's where, to your question about what tools do they have to bring to bear, one of the first things and how we got into business in the first place is to take a look at the data that helps those retailers understand who their actual customer is, which products are most popular, which products with, you know, the best margins are going to serve them best in being the ones they offer to the right customers. You know, there's an adage in entrepreneurial ventures that sometimes you get smaller to grow faster, right? And I think the mindset for years and years and years of these retailers has been, I'm just going to carry the same product to keep up. And sometimes you have to say, maybe I need to figure out which ones actually matter and not try to carry everything and be everything to everyone, because they aren't going to get the foot traffic that is buying all the food, buying all the home goods, and picking up a magnum of wine on the way home. They need to focus on people that are looking for the right products for their taste profiles and their needs.
You mentioned the SKU difference between a large national retailer and an independent operator. And I know that's something I notice. If I go into a Walmart here, I might find a Sierra Nevada Pale Ale six pack or something like that. But you go into an independent retailer, you've got tons of different products to choose from on the shelves. And we were talking before the interview started about the discovery process for the consumer, how it's so different in this form of retail versus other forms of retail. What can independent operators do to really kind of drive home that idea of, hey, discover a new product, try something new, and we're the home for that?
I think they already have been doing that in many ways, and some actually things that they've lost because of the pandemic has had a big impact on their business, and that's being able to have tastings and being able to get consumers in to try the newest, latest thing. And a lot of that was driven, obviously, by the brands and the distributors wanting to run those tastings through the stores. But, you know, at the same time, what makes an independent retailer powerful when it comes to discovery is they actually know their product, right? They're going to take the time to hand sell. When's the last time you were in a Kroger and somebody that worked there stopped you to talk about which wine was the best wine for you to pick up that night for dinner? That just doesn't happen in the other channels. And in this one, they can take advantage of that product knowledge and that kind of long history of what consumers like and don't like about different products. And in fact, what we've found is we work with retailers and we're helping them develop the advertising, the marketing strategies that can target the right consumers locally, is if you actually look at the data of what's in the baskets and you analyze that, you can start to see patterns in taste profiles, in flavor profiles of these consumers that are pairing certain maybe IPAs with certain whiskeys or red wines with bourbons. And those buying habits are actually patterns of behavior that the retailers, if they take the time to focus on understanding the customer, can build their businesses more directly on.
So you mentioned it's the taste profile of the consumer, but there's also quite a bit of localization in terms of demand as well. And in looking at a few case studies regarding the 3x3 platform, I know that's something that you break down as well in terms of what's selling well regionally, what's selling well on the state level, as well as what's selling well at those independent retailers. Why is it important for retailers to kind of take all of that into mind, all of that into consideration, especially in terms of the localization of certain parts of demand?
I think that's a great point, because when you look at this industry, and this is something we're working to shift it throughout the industry, the focus on the consumer happens locally, meaning, you know, consumers' awareness of a vodka or awareness of a new gin might happen, you know, through the media, through social media, through brand awareness type of activities, but it does nothing to help them find it locally, right? And so that's where the sale happens. That's where the transaction happens. Being able to shop locally and build that kind of recursive behavior of shopping the same store over and over and building that loyalty is something that, you know, I think retailers historically have taken for granted, that, you know, they kind of waited to see who walked in the door and then they sold to them. And one of the biggest shifts they have to make is this local shift of understanding who your regulars are, who your best customers are, and how do you go get them And you do that within 2 miles, 3 miles, 5 miles of your store, because people don't travel across the city to show up at a local retail unless there's something really, you know, different and something unique about the way they've built their business. And so there are always exceptions to the rule. Stores like Julio's up in the Boston area that's got this phenomenal whiskey assortment. And so people will drive for miles and miles to go there, but that's, you know, not the normal independent retailer experience.
Now, one of the things that we've kind of touched on throughout the interview so far is because of the 3x3 platform, you're able to get a look at a lot of key data and a lot of key insights on behalf of retailers. What are one or two things someone maybe from the outside looking in that's not that familiar with this sector of retail might not realize about the adult beverage retail sector from a data perspective?
Yeah, I think from a data perspective, one of the things that isn't entirely obvious if you don't know the industry is just how dynamic the buying patterns are and how dynamic the demand patterns are. Trends have taken on a life of their own in the industry over the course of the last several years. And frankly, as consumers have become more sophisticated, demanded more variations and variety in their choices, and the craft, the artisanals, the regional brands have responded by putting more out into the world for people to consume. It's very hard now for any retailer to understand what they should stock or not stock. And you know, unfortunately, that means they're depending on the distributors to advise them. And there's almost ceding control of product selection and merchandising in their businesses many times. And that's something that really the data suggests the trends and the frequency of shifts in product demand are going to continue and to grow more dynamic. And that's something that makes being a retailer in this space very difficult to do.
I want to touch on that distributor portion a moment, because I know certainly from my experience in the industry, you've got great distributors that you can work with. And then you've got also other distributors who are recommending product that you carry, not because it's moving quickly, but because the Best Buy date is heading on this case that they have and they want to get it out of their door. So why is it important for retailers to kind of take ownership of this process, identifying key trends, identifying key products back out of the hands of some of those distributors?
That's a great question, and there's a lot of different answers to that. But the simplest one, I think, is the distributors don't have a relationship with the consumers. The retailer does. And it's the retailer's job, being retailers, to know what people want and to serve them the things that they want, right? To fill the demand that exists today. And I think, unfortunately, because of the nature of the systems, because the three-tier is structured in the way it is, because the demand for performance and sales is nonstop, you do have this almost product push through the three tiers rather than a mindset that says we're going to produce what people want and we're going to shift our products to accommodate the shifts in demand. And retailers have to be the advocates for the consumer. They're talking with the distributors. They have to, you know, position their business so that they've got the right products on the shelves at the right time. And unfortunately, that is a really hard thing to do in this industry. And that's why you see a lot of product collecting dust or having Best Buy dates that go expired. And that's not good for anybody. And I think the industry as a whole has started to figure that out. And I think at the core of how they figured that out is data is just much more prevalent now than it was 20 years ago when you were a manufacturer, a distributor selling beer, wine, or spirits. And so today we can shift our planning cycles and we can shift our manufacturing cycles, but it really depends on the retailers to kind of level up, so to speak, to compete and interact with the distributors and the brands on par.
Now, we mentioned certainly cycling through trends, moving through different trends. And I know a lot of our listeners out there might not be familiar with this part of retail, but it would be similar to fashion trends coming and going. We were talking before the pandemic about how quickly the turns on trends really were in, say, the fashion industry. About how quick are the turns on trends in different portions of this sector of retail? Because I'd imagine it might be different for beer, let's say, than it might be for wine or whiskey.
That's a good point. And one of the differences, and I'm not an expert on the fashion industry, but one of the things that makes trend following and trend reactions difficult in the alcohol industry is that those trends aren't just coming from national manufacturers or international manufacturers, they're also coming from small local groups who set up a shop. And frankly, it's very, you know, relatively easy to set up a local craft brewery and to get your products on the shelves of those local stores around you that are trying to fill the demand for competing locally. And so you suddenly have this proliferation of lots of different brands and lots of different labels that are people are picking through and deciding what to put on the shelves. But you're right. I think across categories, you do see different levels of trend cycles. So, for example, in beer, there is a very, very heavy concentration of craft and artisanal and regional product. And those things will cycle through on a monthly, bi-monthly basis. You know, people don't have a loyalty to products the way they used to in beer and frankly want to try different things. And that's why you see sweet potato beers and you see, you know, I don't know, raspberry cream beers and making up new flavors, perhaps, in trying to give you examples. But when you look at spirits, you see more stable trends, meaning that the trends stay for 4, 6 months, even a year. But you do see kind of a small adjustment in them. So, for example, whiskey has been hot now for a couple of years, but within whiskey, it has shifted from bourbon to Japanese to other American whiskeys to scotch. And so, you know, you have this rotation at a subcategory level in the trends, but as a category stays strong. In local liquor stores, that is in most local liquor stores, except in the South, that tends to be the number one category of sales. In the South, you'd see that replaced by vodka and sometimes tequila, depending on which part of the South you're looking in. So you do see, you know, kind of emerging trends around rum, which isn't surprising in the winter, but it started in the kind of late summer, fall. And gin last year, for example, was on kind of a 6 month roll. And so the trends cycles tend to be different for spirits. And then with wine, it's really, I think, recently been more about packaging than it has been product. As you saw, boxed wines and more portable cans of wine and just new packaging that has been authorized and has been kind of accepted by the market has been more where the wine trends tended to happen. Having said that, you certainly have seen bursts of things like rosés and sparkling wines being, you know, and Proseccos taking off and replacing, you know, more traditional leaders in their categories.
If it helps, I've certainly seen sweet potato beers and raspberry cream ales on the shelf near me. So not making those styles up for sure. So a lot of great insights so far. I want to wrap up here. I know one of the resources that 3x3 produces is called Retail Untapped. It's a great resource for kind of looking ahead, seeing what trends are bubbling to the surface. But I want to ask you to kind of bring out your crystal ball here. What's in store for spirits retail or beer, wine, and spirits retail over the next 1, 3, 5 years?
That's a very loaded question because we have to figure out how we get through this first year. At a high level, I think one of the things you're going to see from the local retailer point of view is that they have to weather a dip in 2022. You know, once we kind of clear the dust of the pandemic and on-premise restaurants and bars start coming back online, you're going to see the pendulum swing for a little bit of time. So that I think 2022 overall for local liquor retail could be tougher, although probably not at a killer level, just a challenge they have to sort out. But within the stores and the things they're going to be selling, I think you're going to see a very big push around smaller format products. We've seen that already with the seltzers, but you're starting to see it with, like I said, wines and even smaller format, 200 mil formats on a lot of spirits because people are trying to respond to the need for variety and the desire for being able to try things, but not have to make kind of commitments to that full fifth, if you will, of a product before you know you like it. So I think that's been a reaction in many ways to the lack of restaurants and bar access, because normally as consumers, we would use the restaurants and bars as our place to try new things. And so now you're seeing this kind of smaller format come in to replace the trial opportunities that restaurants and bars offer. I think you also see a big fight coming between wine and seltzers, because seltzers shot up quickly and took on a big chunk of the market and certainly awareness of consumers. And they took that primarily from wines to a lesser extent from beer. And I think you've got a reaction coming from the wine industry to fight back against that, and a lot more kind of product innovation and product extensions coming from the wine industry to do that over the next couple of years. And then finally, I think there's a couple different trends that have just started to really take strength, but healthier, no alcohol, low alcohol products are getting stronger. And then, you know, we're all on the lookout to see what's going to happen with cannabis. But I think in the next 3 years, you're going to see some real growth of how the cannabis industry impacts alcohol retail.
Some fascinating stuff. I appreciate all the insight you've been able to share today on the podcast, Mike. And thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Take care.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we thank Mike for joining us on the podcast, and hopefully we can catch up with him at the beginning of maybe next year to provide another update on the state of beer, wine, and spirits retail as it is so constantly changing. It's changed so much just in the last year, as he discussed, so we can expect more changes looking forward to 2022. Well, my looking ahead story, it's short and sweet, as Petco went public again on Thursday of this last week. Now, Petco, after they went public, shares surged for them. We don't talk often about share price on the podcast because there's a bit of a disconnect between share price and what's actually going on with the retailer, but shares after the IPO went up 63% for Petco. So I think a relatively successful IPO. It raised $864 million overall. The reason I'm looking ahead to this twofold. One is Petco is looking to pay down debt with the funds coming in. Obviously, it's going to be a positive for them. What are they going to do with the additional funds that'll be freed up that aren't going to that debt service? So that's one very obvious reason I'm looking ahead to it. The other is somewhat selfish because to this point, we get some pet updates from general merchandisers. We obviously get updates from Chewy during their earnings calls, but Petco and PetSmart are private companies, or they have been to this point. So the ability to get a closer look at what these companies are doing is going to be absolutely a treat for us on the podcast. And we do know, because Petco has been releasing numbers, of course, prior to their IPO, that revenue rose for them in the 39 weeks ending October 31st by 9% year over year. However, we also know that the company isn't profitable. So just like Chewy, sales are going up and up and up. But just like Chewy, they're losing money. Petco reported a loss of $20 million during that 39 weeks. Maybe not a lot when you look at the sales that they're bringing in, and certainly better than the year prior because they lost $88 million during the first three quarters of 2019. But it's going to be a lot of fun, certainly, for us to be able to look at the numbers and see if Petco, now that there's this increased transparency, can they emerge profitable? And I think that's the question for every pet retailers. You know, folks have said the bottom line at PetSmart might be struggling as well. And at this point, again, conjecture, because we don't get a full look at those financials, but you have these major players in the pet space, all of them trying to crawl to profitability. Chewy's balance sheet looking better and better. Petco's balance sheet looking better and better. What's it going to look like in 2021, especially after all of these pets were adopted during the course of the pandemic in 2020. Well, that'll do it for us this week on the Retail Focus Podcast. Coming up next week, we come at you double barrel with interviews, as we'll be joined by Rod Sides of Deloitte. They ran a consumer expectation survey for 2021. He will join us to discuss those brand new numbers just recently came out. We're also going to talk to Shash Anand. Had Shash on the show before. He is the VP of Product Strategy at Sodi, and he's going to discuss what their data suggests a good technological experience is for a customer in a retail store in 2021. And furthermore, the back-end processes that have to update as a result of the proliferation of technology in brick and mortar stores that we saw in 2020. So a couple of great interviews coming up next week, and we'll see you 7 days from now.
This has been been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.